Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Barbara Morgan, and you're listening to Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast. This week on On Story, we're joined by David Self, the writer behind films like Road to Perdition and 13 Days. In this episode, Self dissects his career breaking into the industry to writing crime and historical dramas. David Self was born into a family of community college and high school teachers. He broke with family tradition and spent most of his waking hours trying to break into Hollywood. In 1994, he found success and was hired to pen the remake of the 1963 film The Haunting for Steven Spielberg. His credits also include Road to Perdition, 13 Days, and Wolfman. Crime and thriller film Road to Perdition is an adaptation of the DC Comics graphic novel series of the same name. Starring Paul Newman and Tom Hanks, it follows the story of a mob enforcer's son in 1930s Illinois who witnesses a murder, forcing him and his father to take to the road down a path of redemption and revenge. 13 Days is a tale of truths about how the Kennedy administration struggled to contain the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. I sat down with David Self for a panel about his work at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of 13 Days, courtesy of Beacon Pictures. Clips of Road to Perdition, courtesy of DreamWorks Films and 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. Clips of Wolfman, courtesy of Universal City Studios. When we started the festival in 94, it was the era of the spec script, which was a really interesting time period in Hollywood. And one of our first big guests that we were lucky to get was Shane Black, who had sold this whatever biggest spec script sale. And it started all this chatter finally about screenwriters getting recognized in some way, right? And you came into the market in this kind of time period, right? In that point?
Yeah. The Last Boy Scout, I think, is Shane's giant sale. Everybody was a beacon for all of us wannabe screenwriters at the time. My first job was in 1994. So my first hired screenwriting job. My entire family's teachers, and I thought I was going to be a teacher my whole childhood and early college years and stuff like that. And in college, I ended up sort of as a Shakespearean, and that was my thing. And I still love that. So my sense of drama was kind of, I guess why I became a screenwriter versus becoming a novelist or whatever was probably because I was into plays. I began writing spec scripts and taking a class at UCLA Extension. I had a terrific teacher there who was very supportive. And after reading a couple of my scripts, she said, you should really be trying to aggressively go get an agent and stop taking classes and just keep writing. I worked, my first gig was for Emilio Estevez, writing an oil well firefighter action movie set in Kuwait.
So I'm going to flip to, especially the films you've got made. You were in with some big folks. I mean, you were working with Spielberg's company. You were working with Larry Kasdan on some stuff. You were working with Sam Mendes. You've had a list of big directors at the time that you were working with on your scripts. How did that development process work? Because some of these films, by the time they got to the screen, you'd worked with a couple different directors to revamp and revamp and revamp. And I think you've had to see a lot of projects from you're almost there and then a new director comes on board, et cetera. So can you talk a little bit about what development hell is actually?
Sure. Yeah, I'll be your Virgil in development hell. Yeah, it's what you're really writing for in some ways is a very small audience of people. This is the strangest paradox with this kind of thing. You're trying to trigger directors to come on board your project. You're trying to trigger actors to come on board your project. And the studio to feel like it's commercially viable, that you're tapping into something. And you're really writing for that very limited audience. And there are certain things you can kind of, if you recognize that, sometimes you can push buttons. For instance, when I was working on Road to Perdition, we knew that Tom Hanks wanted to play a bad guy. And so we crafted that and tailored it a bit more for Tom to try to entice him to come on board that project. So, you know, there's countless ways to kind of navigate this initial world, but you're trying to get this kind of magic set of elements to line up all at once and then go get a green light. So
how did you get involved with 13 Days to begin with? And then you did have a couple different directors on that. How did the way you were going to tell the story and the way the story ultimately got told, how did that kind of shift and differ? And
the story behind that project was I'd been hired, I was 25, I think. I'd been hired to write a action movie based, you know, kind of a Die Hard in the White House type of project. Like, you know, they later made, you know, they made versions of that movie for Columbia. And I'd written this action movie. It was just a straight up 90s action movie, but it had become a competitive project against Beacon Pictures' Air Force One. So the two projects were neck and neck for a little while, and Air Force One eventually won out. And in a, if you can't beat them, join them sort of way, I went and went to work for the company that had produced. They approached me with the idea of doing a Cuban Missile Crisis movie. But the producer at the time wanted to do a love story set against the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I said, well, you know, that might be good, but that's not really what I do well. And so I would prefer to do like a suspense thriller version of the Cuban Missile Crisis and tell the real story. And so I did. And people liked the script. It became hot. People attached to it. A lot of different directors were interested. The first one to really commit to doing it was Larry Kasdan, who I idolized. He's a writing hero of mine. And he decided he wanted to work on a piece of material of his own. And Kevin Costner had become attached to the project. He had decided it probably wasn't going to be for his next movie. And so given the availability slot of Kevin Costner, they felt like they had to move on from Larry. And so the script really didn't change much under Larry's sort of regime. He had a few thoughts and things like that, but really it didn't get that far along. After Larry, they brought in Phil Robinson, who decided to rewrite the entire script. And I was not on the project. I was fired off the project essentially at that point. However, when he turned in his script, the folks decided that they preferred to go back to the original one. So he left the project and Roger Donaldson came on. I came back, and then the shooting script was the closest of any of my scripts to the original one I had written.
I always think it's interesting to make a movie where everybody knows how it ends, right? And so that obviously, like in Apollo 13, we knew, hopefully people knew what happened. So can you talk a little bit about that part? Because it is a suspenseful movie and you have to create suspense out of...
It's old fashioned, you know, was it Samatet or Coleridge, suspension of disbelief kind of stuff. You want to kind of create, I think when you're dealing with any story where you kind of know the ultimate end of it, the world does not blow up. You need to find a level of immediacy and engrossment. So you and sympathy with the characters so that you forget that you're not outside the movie, that you're actually in the movie with these people trying to solve the problem.
On Story is brought to you in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software. Find out more information about Final Draft at finaldraft.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival, we'll be back in a moment. So you told that story from one person's perspective, basically.
Yeah.
And was there a point in there, because obviously at the point that you made that movie, there were already a lot of other opinions about what really happened and what, how do you, when you're telling a story like that, how do you filter out?
Yeah, I could spend a few hours talking about our interaction with the military on that project. Because the one hand, they're heroes for deterring a nuclear war. On the other hand, some of the characters didn't come off so well with their sort of behavior in the process. But yeah, I spent a lot of time doing, we talked to the folks that were alive at the time. McNamara was alive. I spoke with McNamara. Ted Sorensen was alive. Spoke with Ted Sorensen. Several of the, you know, one of the pilots from one of the U-2 flights was still around. In that level of research, there was a level I did with secondary sources, sources, and another level when the budget came available to go meet these people and scout sites and things like that. So there was kind of two tiers of research, one that for the script and then another for production, and the production script that kind of got even more in depth with like technical jargon and stuff like that. So, you know, obviously with the cottage industry of opinion and sort of legacy making that happens with big people that have a historical presence, you know, and wanting to tell the version their way, I settled on a weird vehicle in Kenny O'Donnell, kind of. He's the chief of staff, but he was this kind of Irish Paul from Boston that felt like my family, and I knew that guy. But what made it really critical, what made it really available was his son had 24 hours of recorded interviews that Kenny O'Donnell had done with the reporter Sander Van Oker and firsthand tapes. So I had these 24 hours of tapes of interviews of the chief of staff in the White House at the time. So I thought, this is the guy that's kind of probably got the most intimate access and look. And you're kind of expecting, if you go into this movie not knowing much, you would kind of expect it to be a Kennedy movie. But instead, it becomes, you know, it's a guy who's a satellite member of that world who has a different perspective on it. So that's kind of why I chose him. I thought it was different and kind of went a little bit against expectations. And I felt I could write that character as a Boston Irish backroom Paul kind of guy.
Helen, I want you to keep the kids close tomorrow. I want you to leave the TV on. I want you to sleep with it on in the bedroom until I call you and tell you you can turn it off.
What's happened?
Nothing. Nothing you don't already know about. Just have the car ready to go in case I call. The civil defense warning comes on.
What happens to you?
I'm not leaving without you.
I've always loved the beginning of Road to Perdition, that, you know, kind of weird voice of the kid talking to you as, or not the kid, but the Michael character talking to you about about his father. Yeah, just this little piece that's not much. You're really just giving somebody a breadcrumb.
There are many stories about Michael Sullivan. Some say he was a decent man. Some say there was no good in him at all. But I once spent 6 weeks on the road with him in the winter of 1931. This is our story.
But it was an interesting breadcrumb. And so that was a graphic novel, right? And you changed some things in that novel. I mean, you added a character, right? And so how did you go about looking at how you were going to begin telling that story? And that was kind of before people went wacko with graphic novels, right?
So Yeah. I think comic books and graphic novels in around 2000 were a dirty word, really. I mean, it was considered lowbrow filmmaking to be interested in doing a comic book movie. I had never been snobby about I love comic books, and I'd never been snobby about my sources of inspiration. And I really enjoyed Max Allen Collins's graphic novel. But I'd actually, prior to that, I'd been putting an overall deal at DreamWorks and was pitching material. They were pitching stuff to me to find a good project that was a good fit. And this is kind of this was prior to the kind of resurgence of mobster kind of stuff, even prior to Sopranos, actually. I was like, I'd love to find a G-Man movie or a 30s gangster movie to do. I just felt like that was a genre that I enjoyed in the past, I hadn't seen recently, and to reinvent it. But the way to go about it was to, I felt like to tell, you know, if you were going to try to do a Godfather-esque kind of movie, to tell it from the bodyguard's point of view rather than the family's point of view, go with the henchman. And then Max's graphic novel came across. I loved it. I thought it was a lone wolf and cub story that I felt we could really mesh with my own sort of sense of Irish heritage and so on that I kind of carry with me, my own cultural baggage. And I was like, this could be a real good project for me. So I took a shot at it, and it worked out.
How did you look at approaching that? Because as you're pointing out, there wasn't a lot of that source material being turned into film, and that how you were going to take this character pre-Sopranos, where we became somehow in 2001, whatever, okay with psychopaths. Because he doesn't come across that way, but you never really do get a great sense of who he is and how he got there. What was it that drew you to that?
You know, I had uncles of my own in growing up in, I was born in Texas, but grew up in the Northeast. My mother's family's from the Boston area, and I grew up in a very Irish Catholic Boston thing. And I had uncles who, I didn't know what they did. They kind of, I think they had things to do with, the troubles in Ireland at times. And I wasn't 100% sure. And, he works for blah, blah, blah. And so when the character, one of the two boys in Road to Perdition are talking about their dad, he works for Mr. Rooney. And that's all they know.
What's Papa's job? He works for Mr. Rooney. Why? Well, Papa didn't have a father. So Mr. Rooney looked after him.
I know that, but what's his job?
The idea of not really understanding the adult world and what your parents do, I thought was really powerful, and the mystery around that.
So when you're looking at a project like that, how do you, because you added a whole character, right? We got the Jude Law character.
Right, yeah.
Why did you feel like it was necessary to do that? How did that fit into your storytelling to take it from that page to the screen?
In the medium of the graphic novel, you know, it's about the artwork, and one of the things that the Road to Perdition graphic novel had in spades was just very kinetic drawings of mob violence, basically. And so in the storyline, it was a series of mobsters that were sent to take out Michael Sullivan, and he kills them all. And basically, so there was not a unifying sense of threat or quality. It was just a series of splash pages that were, you know, spectacular, but they didn't give you the sort of emotional thing you need for a film, which was an antagonist. So we needed a sort of, even though Paul Newman is really Tom Hanks's antagonist, we needed a sort of physical incarnation of his effort to kill Michael Sullivan. So that was kind of the decision that we made there, was to create a character that was a psychopath, even scarier than Michael Sullivan, who could hunt him down successfully and have a chance.
Can you keep a secret?
I'm press.
Which paper?
All over. I'm something of a rarity.
How's that?
I shoot the dead. Dead bodies, that is. I don't kill them.
I should hope not.
Always fascinated me, the look of them. You know? You ever seen one?
Yeah.
Sorry for you. Terrible thing. But it sure makes you feel alive, don't it?
So did you feel like it was a father-son story when you read it, when you read the comic book? Or was it that something really that it morphed into more when you, because it's clearly, you know, rooted in that?
I think the seeds of it were there, but I think I probably took it a bit further than it had existed in the original. The original, you know, had the lone wolf and cub element and the story being told by the young son, Michael Jr., but it was really more of a narrative frame sort of device, and it wasn't really as deeply woven into the story, I think, as it possibly could have been.
What an incredible cast. You got Sam Mendes, and then right after his film that makes him a household name as a director, yeah. And then this amazing, I mean, much was said about Paul Newman. Did it shift? Is that the script that you wrote? Or did things shift when you all of a sudden had these heavyweights that joined in the film?
It shifted to a degree. The script that existed had a bit more of the narrative voice of Michael involved. It wasn't a voiceover narrative throughout. It wasn't that kind of thing. It was in the frame. And I think the opening you described was cut down considerably. It was a more of a, you know, let me tell you a story of my father who was called the Angel of Death kind of thing, and what he was, but I knew him as a man, you know, kind of idea. And it was a much more elaborate opening. And in the process, generally, almost always, words get removed dialogue gets shortened, expressions, brilliant actors tell you with a look what you give them four lines to do, and they don't need the four lines, they just need a look. And so you see a lot of your dialogue tend to pare away over time. There was some suspense set pieces in the original script that they didn't have the money to do and were cut. And just one funny little Texas connection with Road to Perdition, which is in order to like grow the cornfields of 1930s period corn, they had to go to Texas A&M and get seeds from the catalog there, because I guess modern corn is too tall for, and that everybody in the Midwest who really knew corn would go crazy seeing 7 foot tall hybridized corn in the movie. So
I want to talk about the Wolfman next, because I love that Wolfman. And I thought it was really interesting that you made the choice to change the story quite a bit, right? How did that happen? I mean, in revisioning.
Well, I want to point out that Andy Walker is shared writing credit on The Wolfman. And he was the first writer on the project and made a lot of the basic choices that existed or that you see in the current film. The old, you know, George Wagner movie, it's a 1941 movie, in its time was it's the classic Universal monster movie. But it was also really scary, apparently, in its time. I mean, people were terrified of that movie. And so I think there was at the heart of the interpretation of it was trying to wrestle with whether this movie was a monster movie with kind of a mythic structure and kind of archetypes and that kind of stuff, or whether it was trying to be a truly terrifying, like kind of modern horror movie in the frame of stuff that was out at the time, like The Grudge and stuff like that. So there was this strange tension that we're trying to live up to being truly, truly scary by contemporary standards and being an homage and honoring this is a universal monster character who can only look a certain way. He can only evolve his look so far. He had to be a wolf man, not a like werewolf with, you know, wolfed out kind of features and stuff like that. So that was a kind of initial tension there that we were wrestling with the whole time. Andy had set up a character in Anthony Hopkins' character, Lord Talbot, a domineering father character with a son who was not, you know, up to standards.
Poor little Lawrence. You were the fragile one. I removed the powder from those shells many, many years ago. But I confess, I was quite overwhelmed by your enormous courage. Finally, you're the man I always wanted to be.
Lawrence!
My boy.
So he had set that up, and we felt that it was a strong kind of conflict for them, but we felt like we could, you know, work it in more completely into the storyline. So there were things that we added to enhance that idea, or just kind of put more scenes basically to play that out. This notion that he's, you know, which goes to the heart of the idea of being a curse, you know, the werewolfism. And so some of the backstory existed with the Anthony Hopkins's wife having killed his own wife and having had to live with it and lock himself up for years. That was Andy's concept. And in some cases, just dialogue that we altered to better fit the people we knew were at that point playing the roles, Benicio del Toro and Anthony Hopkins. So we kind of worked toward their strengths and again, their abilities to either memorize giant amounts of dialogue, which Anthony can do. It was kind of a adjustment to their strengths and telling, you know, a lot of those changes on that part of the story. I wasn't exactly trying to get in step with Andy's voice as much as at the time Mark Romanek was attached to direct the project when I came on board. So in film, when the director's on board, they're running the show and they're determining the direction and changes of the script and things like that. So you're working to their sensibility. Ultimately, I think he ended up not making the movie, and Universal hired Joe Johnston to come on, whose sensibilities are considerably different. And so then you're adapting to that director's vision for how to do the movie. So the final movie is Joe's vision of sort of more campy moments and fun, those types of things, more of the monster movie version as opposed to the gritty horror movie version.
I would imagine you get, because you've adapted a lot of different projects, that you get a lot of adaptations that come across your desk. And I think at one point I read you were working on Gates of Fire.
It's an awesome book.
Yeah, and amazing book.
We almost, that was another one of those projects that I think we tapped into early. We hit on it before Gladiator's success. It was a great book and could clearly be made into a great movie, but then had a competing project in 300. And at one point, they almost merged the two projects, and it would have been Leo DiCaprio from my movies, and the director of 300. So that would have been funny.
How do you decide what piques your interest when you're doing that? And how do you work in your original content? Like, are you still working on original content? Or are you?
Yeah, still working. I'm currently working on some original stuff. Sort of TV streamer set in 19th century Arabia. I'm a huge period piece lover. And for me, period stories are basically like sci-fi. It's the escapist thing I like, and a completely different world. and, you know, take you to a different place with a few different rules, but all, you know, mostly recognizable. So I feel like those type of stories really appeal to me. And in the case of Gates of Fire, I was so transported by Steve Pressfield's book. I had to do it. And, you know, I was really excited about adapting it.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979, and by Bogle Family Vineyards, sixth-generation farmers and third-generation winemakers based in Clarksburg, California, makers of sustainably grown wines that are a reflection of their family values since 1968. This project is supported in part by the Texas Commission on the Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts on the web at arts.gov. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, and Jamal Knox. Editing help from Travis Neely and Travis Kennedy Sound. Music is by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from the Sound Lab, Travis Kennedy Sound, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.